We're now in what we call the home stretch, which I think it's a baseball term. I could be wrong about that. I think, yeah, it's a baseball term. So it's not part of your cultures, but we're almost finished. I've been asked a lot of questions, and I'm going to answer most of them in as I talk about sponsoring and as I talk about meetings. And then I'll go through all of them just to see whether I've answered them all. But someone asked me, if I understand you correctly, you don't use the AA 12 and 12 or the OA 12 and 12 in your step work. And when I work with sponsees, I don't normally. I love the AA 12 and 12. I think it's an absolutely brilliant and great work. I'm not as much in love with the OA 12 and 12. I think it's not a consistent piece of writing. And there is a committee in OA that's been created to look at the OA 12 and 12 and see if it's up to date and if it completely does the job. There's some wonderful stuff in the OA 12 and 12. I just don't use it as a guide to working the steps, and I don't think it's intended to be a guide to working the steps. It's a series of essays on the steps, just as Bill's AA 12 and 12 is a series of essays. It says, for instance, you mentioned not using the seven deadly sins in step four, even though Bill is suggesting with big capital letters. Well, actually, with all due respect, if you read the AA 12 and 12, you'll see that Bill looks at the seven deadly sins and brings them all down to one deadly sin, pride. He doesn't use the seven deadly sins other than as an example of how all those seven deadly sins become part of ego and part of pride. So I don't use them because I find the simple methods of the big book to be faster and more powerful. So as wonderful, I mean, I normally don't get the time to quote from the AA 12 and 12, but there are some incredibly wonderful parts of the AA 12 and 12. That one is, we've never been one among many, a member of the family, a worker among workers. We always strive to be at the top of the heap or to dive down below. That speaks to me so much. We've never tried to be a member of the human race, and it speaks to me. There are things in the AA, the last paragraph of the 12th step essay is so wonderful. All the discussions about financial security and the discussions about if a job becomes simply a means of survival as opposed to a means of being useful in life, a good way of checking. I love the AA 12 and 12, but the seven deadly sins are not what is suggested. If you read that carefully, you'll see that he takes each one of them and ends up going to pride as being the issue of them. So I just wanted to point that out. And I think most of the other ones. Okay, let me go back to job or no job, wife or no wife. We simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. All through OA, and I understand AA, and I've told in NA and all that, there are sponsors who are more than willing to be in charge of your life, who tell you that they have to be in charge of your life, and that you have to submit, that submission is the whole issue. Maybe that works, and I'm not going to be the person to say that that's wrong. I'm just going to say that's not what I do, nor do I think that it is consistent with the concept of we simply do not stop drinking or compulsive eating so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. I want to live my life according to the big book, and I want to live my life so that no one is dependent upon me, but ends up being dependent only upon a higher power. The only thing I want to be is the messenger of a message about how to get a spiritual awakening and get a direct contact between the higher power of an individual and the individual, him or herself. So my method of sponsoring is different from the experience of most people. And I don't suggest you do it. Many people, I have close friends in the program who sponsor completely differently, who have daily contact with their sponsees and vice versa, who count on that daily contact as part of their recovery. It's not what I do, and the only time I will be critical of it in only two ways. One is, if a sponsor says, you must do what I say, I question that person's ability to be consistently God-oriented all the time. Because I think if I were saying that to people, I would start putting my will over God's will. So I question. I'm not saying it's not true. But I would say that I think any person who thinks that he or she can be in charge of anyone else's life has to wonder whether that person is being consistent with their higher power's will as opposed to their own will. I only suggest that. I only question that. The other thing is, there are many ways of sponsoring that take a lot of time to sponsor. Daily phone calls, just working, especially the daily phone calls. And I have been to meetings where daily phone calls is a matter of course with each sponsor and each sponsee. I've been to those meetings where there may be five newcomers, and then they go around the room and say, is there anyone willing to sponsor? And people will say, well, I've been abstinent for 300 years and I've lost so many weight, but I don't have time to sponsor. I don't have time to sponsor. And if there's a method of sponsoring that causes the sponsor, A, to spend more time with people who have already recovered than people who have not yet recovered, and creates a meeting in which there's no one available to sponsor those who still suffer, that's going contrary to Tradition 5, which says the primary purpose of every group is to carry the message to those who still suffer. A sponsor who spends more time with someone who has already recovered and less time with those who haven't recovered is not carrying the message to those who still suffer. So this method of sponsoring that involves a great deal of contact between a sponsor and a sponsee, even past step 9, is a method that can work if there's a lot of recovery, and there are always a lot of recovered people available to sponsor. In the city of Minneapolis, the Twin Cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul, there are a tremendously strong group of people who have a number of meetings in which that method of sponsoring is the way they do it. There are always people available to sponsor because they're just full of vitality. So I don't call that down in any way, shape, or form. But that same method of sponsoring in a town where there aren't that many people coming can create a situation where newcomers don't have anyone to help them. And it seems to me that misses the point of what we're doing here. So I only point that out, and I'm not being critical of any other method of sponsoring, nor am I saying that my method of sponsoring is terrific. I'm telling you what I do only as a way of helping you figure out how you want to do it, in your own method. But I think it's very important to make sure that the sponsee understands that whatever it is that you're doing, you're simply a messenger. And that you are not in charge of them. They are in charge of their own recovery. I've been asked, and some of the questions are, have you ever fired a sponsee? No. They often will drop from me, and sometimes like flies, because I don't hold their hands. I met with a person who really seemed very keen, and I said, okay, here's what I like, here's what I want you to read, and then we'll discuss what you've read. And she said, she wrote me an email. I don't know why she couldn't phone me. I would have been happy to receive the phone call because it doesn't bother me if they don't want me to sponsor them. And she said, no, I need someone with more hands-on. I need someone I can talk to. It's fine. I start off by saying I'm not your father, your mother, your confessor, your lawyer. Certainly I'm not your lawyer. Your advisor. I'm here to tell you what I've been taught about a particular method of doing the steps. And I'm here to help you understand that method as I was taught, and I'll do anything I can to help you work the steps. But I'm not here to give you advice, and I don't expect you to call me daily. If you want to call someone daily, call someone who's still suffering, because that'll help both of you. It doesn't mean people haven't phoned me on a daily basis. That there have been times when they have, and I haven't minded. I mean, it takes time, but I haven't minded. So have I ever fired anyone? No. But people get very bored with me because there isn't much I can tell them other than, you're calling me all upset and things are bothering you. What do you do? I don't know what you do. Do step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, and you'll know what to do. So I don't have any great advice for anyone because I'm not their advisor. I don't know what's right for them. I know it would be right for me if I were in that situation. I think I do at times, but I have no idea what's right for them in their situation. They have their own conception of a higher power. They have their own deep values. They have their own sense of guilt and their own sense of what makes them a human being. And it's not up to me to tell them what they should be doing. I know that if they work step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, or if they've already recovered, they work step 10, that they will get an answer. And that answer will be the right one for them. It may not be the right one for me, but it's the right one for them. God bless them. The only concern I've never had anyone say, yes, I know the only answer is that I must kill him. No, I've never had that. I suppose if that happened, I might ask them to get a second opinion somewhere. You know, is there anyone else up there? Kind of thing. But that's never happened. So I've never turned anyone down either. Once, about 15 years ago, I turned someone down. And as I recall it, I was a little concerned about the health, the mental health of that person. But in retrospect, I shouldn't have turned her down. But I did. And I've been willing to sponsor people who I had very grave doubts about their ability to work the steps and all that. But, you know, because I don't give them anything, I don't give them a shoulder to cry on, I don't give them anything, they soon learn that all I'm there for is to go through the book, explain what the book says, ask them if they want to do it, tell them how to do it, and support them as they do it. So when I meet with a sponsee, if they say, will you sponsor me? I say, sure, I'd be happy to. Let's work out a time. And so I don't even know how many people I sponsor. I have no idea how many people I've brought to. They have to keep track of where they are because I can't remember it. I'm an old man. I say, well, okay, I'd be happy. What I'd like to do when we meet first, and I always make an appointment to meet, I'd like you to write down a food diary or the foods that are your big problems and start thinking about and read the doctor's opinion and Bill's story and there is a solution and more about alcoholism, the doctor's opinion in the first three chapters of the big book. And I want to, and then we'll talk about what you've read. When I meet with them, I get a sense of how well they read, because in English it certainly is difficult, and maybe it is in other languages. There are ideas in the big book that are not that easy. So I want to know how well they can remember what they read and how well they understood what they read, because that will help me determine how fast or how slow we'll be going. Sometimes I have to go over it word for word, and sometimes I can say, You remember this? Well, this particular paragraph is important. And that's the extreme that I've worked with. Sometimes I've worked with people who have to not every word explained, but, go over inch by inch every word to go over it with them. But what I end up doing at the first or maybe the second or maybe the third meeting, depending on how much they've retained and how much they've read, is to develop really three plans with them. The first is the plan of eating. I help them work out what for them is a reasonable way of abstaining from the foods, food ingredients, and eating behaviors that have created their cravings. And I work hard with them on that, and I question them, and I bring forward whatever kind of other examples, and I try to winnow it down so that it becomes very clear to them what their particular food issues and eating behaviors are. And then I say, okay, I also would like to work out with you a timetable, a plan for working the steps. How long are we going to spend on that? Because if you simply started off on abstinence and plan of eating without knowing when you're going to finish or when you hope to finish, it'll be like any other diet that it's great for a while and then your mind may send you back to eating. And then I ask them to work out a plan and a strategy for a day-to-day living if they're tempted, which may include phoning in their food. It may include, if you're tempted, you drink a glass of water, you throw out everything in your house while you're working the steps. And I say, given that after step 9, it can be in your house and you won't want it, but between the time you start being abstinent and the time you finish step 9, you're in danger. You're in a race with your mind. Either your mind is going to persuade you to go back to the food, or you're going to give up your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand God, finish step 9 and have sanity and not want this stuff. So you're in a race, and let's work out a way by which you can keep abstinent while you're working the steps, because that is essential to the honesty that's required in steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And, you know, I say to them, and I do say to them, if at 4 in the morning you feel like eating a donut, call me. My wife may mind, but she will understand. And I will not mind. And I will meet with you. Because what would an alcoholic do, a member of AA do, if someone phoned and said, I'm about to have a bottle of beer? They, you know, they might talk on the phone, but the chances are they'd go meet with them over a cup of coffee. And I'm willing to do that, and I'm prepared to do that. No one, very few people ever take it. I also say, if you've already eaten a donut, call me in the morning. I don't want to talk to a drunk. You know, I'll talk to you once you've been sober a little bit. And so if I have someone, by the way, who relapses, I sit down with them. I say, there are only two causes of relapse. Either your body was talking or your mind was talking. Let's figure out whether it was one or the other. And maybe you were eating foods that you shouldn't be eating. Maybe your plan of eating didn't eliminate all the foods that cause you cravings. Let's work it through. Let's see if maybe let's talk about what you've been eating in the last couple of days before your relapse. Maybe you were eating something that would make my mind think, wait a minute, why is he eating that? Or why is she eating that? And on the other hand, it means that you haven't been following the strategy that we worked out for a day-to-day existence. You're not working the steps. Either it's the body or the mind. What are the other two options? So I never fire anyone who relapses. I say, let's work it through. Let's just see what mistakes you made so you won't make them again. Our program is a program of regeneration and rebirth. Who am I to say that they aren't worthy of me? Why would I fire anyone who has a desire to stop eating compulsively? It's important for me to help them as much as I can. At a certain point, and it's happened only with one or two people in my experience, whom I've sponsored, I've said, I don't know how else I can help you. Tell me, why is this happening? I mean, I've had one person. And this is, again, phone and telephone. I couldn't meet with that person in another city. And I haven't had good experience with this kind of sponsoring. Who continued to insist that being abstinent for 2 days meant that it was time for him to do a step 10, not a step 4. And this was somehow a matter of principle with him. And I said, you aren't recovered until you've worked through 4 through 9 and have been abstinent through that. Because that's sort of the definition of the big book. And he kept arguing with me and that kind of resistance. I mean, eventually, it became so boring that he left. I didn't fire him. Well, you're firing me. I'm not firing you. Tell me how I can help you. All I can do is tell you what the steps say in the big book, or at least how I interpret the steps. There's nothing more I can do. But I'm certainly not going to listen to you whine. That's not my job. And I'm not interested. I don't know if you ever heard, what whining means. And you can catch the pun then when I say, people have said, would you like some cheese with your wine? It's not my job to listen to whining. You want to whine, do a step 4 on what bothers you, and you'll find out in step 4 what your role is, and that'll give you the sense of going on to step 5, 6. Then talk to me about it in step 5, if you want. So that's how I work it. And as we develop these sort of 3 plans, and I promise all the support I can, I then meet with them at whatever intervals seem reasonable to them and to me. I mean, I have family obligations, I have work obligations, I can meet with people, and I have other compulsive eaters I work with, and we work together. I go through the book just as I went through the book with the person that we work together with, and just as I go through book at these workshops, the speed is up to them, not up to me. at a certain point, we discuss what it means to take step three. Then we take step three. He or she says the step three prayer. I bring out the forms. I say, these are the forms. This is how to fill them out. I work with them on that. If you have any problems about how to fill them out, let's meet again, and I'll be happy to give you examples or to tell you how I might look at some of the issues you want to bring up. If you don't know how to fill it out, let's take your most difficult resentments and go across the sheet instead of down each column. And I leave them to their step four. And I say, do you want to do step five with me, or do you want to do it with someone else? They say, I want to do it with you. Fine. If they say, I want to do it with someone else, I say, that's fine. Let me tell you how, once they're ready to do step five, I'll say, okay, let's, I should have said, by the way, the plan for working the steps might include making an appointment for step five, as I suggested some time ago, right? So I said, if you don't want to do step five with me, which is fine, let me tell you how I see step five as being done so that you have a sense of how long it might take, and find the person, do it with that person. And don't forget, you have to be delighted, look the world in the eye, be alone, be able to be alone at perfect peace and ease, and your fears have to have fallen from you. So I give the checklist, and don't forget that last paragraph where you have to admit to God and see if everything's ready. Then you do six and seven and eight. And when you're ready to make your amends, when you've filled out the amends form, if you want to meet with me or meet with the person you did step five with, certainly meet, because you will not have the same sense of possibilities that anyone who's been in OA for a long time will have, because we've seen all kinds of people make amends. We've heard people talk about it. If this is a relative newcomer, that person may not have the same experience and may not be open to the possibilities of what kind of amends can be made. And then they make their amends. I give whatever guidance I'm able to, and by guidance I mean simply I ask them, I guide them to their own conclusions about what's right for them, not what's right for me. And once they recover and all these promises become true, as they always do, I say, fine, that's fantastic. Now let me talk to you about what step 10, 11, and 12 are about. And go out and sponsor. It's your duty now to sponsor. It's not just your duty. If you don't sponsor, you're going to die. And generally speaking, one thing that in the meetings I go to at my hometown, I'm sort of like a senior kind of person. I've been around a long time. So when it comes time to identify myself as a sponsor, I do identify myself, but I almost always encourage people to go to my sponsees. If they ask me to sponsor them, I will often say, well, so-and-so has more time, than I do. And they work the steps. And when do they contact me? They contact me if they want to do the step five part of a step 10, if they want to share with me the step 10 part, or if they would like some advice on sponsoring. Maybe they're meeting with someone, they don't know how to work with that person, they've met with certain issues. And I give them whatever experience I have. And we see each other occasionally, and occasionally they tell me, I think you better do a step 10. They'll do that because I ask them to watch me carefully and to see if I'm getting into a bad stage. And we talk, and sometimes I do my step five part of my step 10 with them, because they're amazing. They're more amazing than I am. They're absolutely incredible people. Some of the people I've sponsored in my life, I'm just in awe that I have had the privilege of sponsoring such amazing people, people with much greater weight loss than I have, who have overcome greater problems than I have. I mean, it's easy for me to talk. I've been trained in this way. I've been trained as a teacher. I've been trained as a lawyer. I've been a politician. I have philosophy background, English background. It's not hard for me to talk. But for these people who have never had that kind of experience, and I grew up in a loving family that intellectually stimulated me. I mean, I had everything I needed. I need love, intellectual stimulation, plus too much food. So I'm just in awe of some of these people. So I don't have a lot of contact with them. I don't require them to contact me or anything like that. They know that if they phone me, as I said, my answer will be, I don't know the answer, do a step 10 on it, which is my answer. I should say that, by the way, I was I don't want to mention any names, but someone said, look, step 10 talks about very clearly, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. And that person, and then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. And that person said, well, isn't that saying you should do it right away and all that? And doesn't that mean that step 10 is not done every so often, but is done right away? And I don't argue the point. I mean, obviously, if you're aware that you're being selfish, dishonest, resentful, and fearful, you should do it right away. And I agree with that. I'm not aware of it until I begin to feel restless, irritable, and discontented. And then it's time for me to take out the forms. So I don't see any inconsistency there. But I did want to point out that the big book is very clear that as soon as we realize we've made a mistake, we should do something about it. And that's very true. I mean, there are times when I have apologized within minutes because I know that if I didn't, you know, I made amends quickly, and it has happened. So I think that's an important aspect and to mention in step 10. I really appreciate having that pointed out. So, you know, sometimes people just fall off. You know, I give them the step 4 forms, and I don't see them. And I don't remember when I last met with them. I mean, I suppose I could find out because they'd be in my appointment book. But, you know, I might see them at a meeting. How are you? And, you know, I haven't finished my step 4, you know. And I say, well, why not? What's standing in your way? Just do it. Just get it done. Is there any way I can help you? But if I don't see them, they're out of my mind. And it's because it's their responsibility. It's not mine. And I don't want to be responsible for another person's life. You know, the big book says on page 96, paragraph 1 of page 108 in the Danish version, to not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time in any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. And I take that seriously. Now, I want to tell you a story about how I began my recovery after 6 or 7 years in the program. I had created on my own a meeting that was start off being well attended, and I began to relapse, and since I was the only constant person there, it began to be less well attended and less well attended and less well attended until I was the only person going to that meeting, and I finally closed it, and I started going to another meeting which had some really powerful people in it. And I was still eating, coming to meetings, talking a blue streak, and eating. People would say to me, how are you, Laurie? I'd say, fine. And they'd say, good, good, love to hear you talk. You know so much, it's good to hear you talk. One day, Saturday morning, I wish I knew what the day was. I wish I knew the date, because I didn't make a note of it. The shyest woman in the room came up to me. The quietest, nicest, shyest person in the room. A little wisp of the thing. And she said, how are you, Laurie? I said, fine. And she looked at me, she said, I mean, really? And I just, it was like a blow between the eyes. Now, I know, obviously what I said was I'm in terrible, terrible shape. But there are people who would have said, you have no right to take my inventory. You know, this is an anonymous program and you can't judge me and, you know, I'm never coming to this meeting again. You know what? I got to tell you, if I had ended up not going to that meeting again, I would have been doing that meeting a favor and probably doing myself a favor. I was harming Overeaters Anonymous as a whole by talking so wonderfully about the program and persuasively about the program and showing absolutely no recovery whatsoever. So what she did by really challenging me was in the best interest of OA and, frankly, in my best interest as well. If I had left that meeting, I might have left OA, and I might then have realized how desperate I really was and that I really needed more help. Now, she told me later that she did not do that without 3 weeks of prayer. that she just prayed and prayed what she could do. And what I do, what I suggest, what I have done, and what I suggest to anyone else who's ever asked me about this, is if there are people who you think are having problems, do a step 10 on them. Write them down. As a resentment, put them down. Figure out what your fears are, your selfishness and all that. Divorce yourself from your need to change the world or change that person. Divorce yourself from the fear of rejection or of controversy or of conflict. Get rid of those fears. Get rid of the issues of being in control of everything. And you'll know at that point whether the amends you owe to that person is to leave that person alone or to say that person whatever comes to your mind at the moment. I should say that my experience in step 9 is different from a big book study I heard where they say, no matter whether you like it or not, apologize. No matter whether you believe it or not, just go apologize. My experience is that if I did that, they would know that I didn't mean it and it would mean nothing. My experience has been that when I go with an open mind and an open heart, knowing what I've done wrong, the right words come out. At least they're the right ones for me. And so I've relied on the inspiration I get from the higher power of my understanding when my motives are clean, when I'm not trying to change the world or change other people, when I'm simply speaking from my heart in the best interest of another person. So I have at times said to individuals, you look as if you're having problems. Is there a way I can help you? And at other times, I've said nothing. I have found as a man in OA that I am intimidating whether I'm as nice as I can be. My experience has been that if I come off as authoritative, even though I try not to be, and my experience is that I come off as scaring a lot of people, even though I don't mean to. And so I'm very careful with a lot of women in the program in terms of how I speak to them and how I challenge or I don't challenge, because I find, and also as a senior, you know, elder statesman who's a prison been around a long time, you know, I come off with a lot of authority, and so I'm careful what I say to people, and I'm not because I've had some bad experiences where I've said what I thought was something reasonable and someone said, why are you intimidating me? And I just have no thought that I was doing it. So I'm, on a personal level, I try to be very careful. So I use step 10 for everything, and my existence in this program, like it or not, is basically I just do what I can to carry the message, and I sponsor however I can. I know I think I'm a better sponsor now than I was 5 years ago, and I think I was a better sponsor 5 years ago than I was 10 years ago, and I know I was a better sponsor 10 years ago than I was 20 years ago, that's for sure. But whether people relapse or recover is up to them and up to me, and not up to me. I don't take responsibility for anything that they do. I mean, if I'm a bad sponsor, too bad. They picked me, you know, and I'm just telling them what I know. And if what I know isn't good enough to help them recover, let them find someone else to recover. I don't want to be in charge of them. Okay, I just want to see what I've covered that. I want to talk about the traditions as they relate to carrying the message. I was a member of a secret organization within OA called the Traditions Police. Anytime anyone broke a tradition, I was one of those people who stood up and said, you can't do that, that's contrary to tradition 6.7.3. And there are a lot of us in OA who are more than willing to point out the traditions, the breach of traditions. And I no longer fight anything. I'm off the traditions police. I've resigned. They haven't killed me yet, as a result of resigning. I take my guidance as an example from Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, in which there's a passage where AA is just being established in Japan. And someone, an AA member, writes to the central office and says, there's a crisis here because we have regular AA, which has 12 steps and 12 traditions. Well, I don't think that traditions then. 12 steps and we don't charge anything. And then someone has set up an AA where there are only 10 steps and they charge 7 yen a meeting. What do we do? And the responses you'll find in AA Comes of Age is something like, well, God will decide which is the better, which best carries on AA's principles, and you just do what you do. And I guess that's it. I mean, the traditions are traditions. They're not rules. They were developed as a result of experience, and they're not meant to be rules. They're just set out as guidance. An understanding of the traditions from that perspective means that nothing is necessarily against a tradition. It's something that you really have to look at very carefully. For instance, and one of the guides is found at the back of the big book where they have what's called the long form as well as the short form of the traditions. There's a big difference sometimes in them, at least in the way people interpret them. Let me give you one example. Tradition 10. Is that the anonymous? We're anonymous at all levels of... No, 11. So it reads, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. I don't know what page it is in the Danish book. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, television, and other public media communication. By the way, John, the comedian that I talked about, he says that Tradition 3 should read, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking and the ability to pronounce anonymity. But anyway, so that's what it says. Listen to the long form. Our relations with the general public should be characterized by personal anonymity. We think AA ought to avoid sensational advertising. Our names and pictures as AA members ought not to be broadcast, filmed, or publicly printed. Our public relations should be guided by the principle of attraction rather than promotion. There is never need to praise ourselves. We feel it better to let our friends recommend us. Well, can you see that public relations there is the group, and it's AA as a whole, and it's only press, radio, films, television, and other public media communication? I heard a speaker say once that his sponsor told him that you breach that tradition if you are not anonymous at any other level other than press, radio, films, television, and other public media. In other words, for me not to use my last name, for me not to talk to you about who I am at a level where there is no press, where there is no, there are no radios or anything of that sort, or televisions, is a breach of the tradition. Because we can't be anonymous among ourselves, or we shouldn't be. But we seem to, and especially in OA, because somehow we're ashamed of who we are, whereas a recovered alcoholic has some sense of pride in, pride is the wrong word, some sense of thankfulness and gratitude in having recovered. Somehow we hide it, without wanting to be particularly provocative, but I'm going to be provocative. The initials OA are used to tell people where we are at here and where that meeting was, where we ate. And I understand that's what people mostly do. And I ask, why doesn't it say Overeaters Anonymous, a 12-step fellowship for recovery from compulsive eating? No fees, no dues, no scales, it works. Everyone welcome. Why not? That's not press, radio, films, television, other public media. Oh, because they'll know that I'm a compulsive eater? Well, I can only say that people knew I was a compulsive eater. And now that I don't look like a compulsive eater, at least I hope I don't, I don't think I do, I love it that people know that I'm a compulsive eater because they can say, well, what did you used to be like if you're like this now? So, I'm being provocative, but think about it, about our responsibilities. Why don't people know about us? What is going on with us? The other thing about the traditions police is that it's tradition 5 that really defines the purpose of the group. Every OA group, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive eater who still suffers. That's the principal tradition because it comes right from step 12, which is the responsibility of the individual to carry the message. Here it's the responsibility of the group. And that responsibility is so important that it should be the criterion at least one of the criteria, for measuring whether any other actions taken help or hinder the carrying of the message to the compulsive eater who still suffers. Many of us, though, read these traditions as rules to be followed regardless of whether or not they will help or hinder carrying the message to those who still suffer. We interpret them, and we interpret them in ways that might actually be contrary to Tradition 5. I'll give you a simple example. This Blaine, the man who was such a mentor to me and created the forms, the Step 4 forms and the Step 11 forms that you use, and taught me so much about the Big Book, consented, was willing to do a Big Book study for Overeaters Anonymous in my town. And so, you know, and it was an incredible thing that this man would give up 3 days of his life to do something for compulsive eaters. As it turned out, not only he, but he brought in 4 other people with him to help. One recorded, one operated, he used a slide projector for some of his, audio-visual things. And the intergroup agreed, and it was great. So I put up a poster. It said, the Big Book comes alive for OA. An AA speaker brings the book alive for Overeaters Anonymous. It goes through the steps, the directions of the Big Book to help Overeaters Anonymous. And I was phoned by the trustee of my region and by the chair of my region and told, this is a breach of... which tradition was it? It was 10. Overeaters Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. That somehow mentioning AA was a breach of outside, it was a position on outside issues. We're not AA, we're OA, and therefore to say was an AA speaker is a breach. You know what? I started to have arguments with them. I started to get really upset, and finally I just gave up. We started to nitpick over what the OA 12 and 12 says. I said, but we used to bring in AA speakers when, but that was then, this is now, we're different now. And I said, well, a tradition doesn't change its character simply because we have more members, But anyway, I started to get upset, and I said, I'm not going to argue. I changed the poster, to read, a person... I don't remember what I said, but whatever it was. But that was an example of not looking at the whole and looking only at the part. Was this going to help or hinder the carrying of the message of recovery to the compulsive eater who still suffers? My response would be, I think, be wonderful. People would be interested in seeing a long-time AA member's approach, and that it might encourage people to come. I don't know. I might have been right. I might have been wrong. But it certainly wasn't black or white. And sometimes we get black or white. So I encourage you, whenever you look at a tradition and wonder whether it's being breached or not, to remember 2 things. First of all, it's only a tradition. And we are able, as people who do inventories and are able to figure through defects of character, we can change it any time. If we make a mistake, we can make up for that mistake. So don't get too upset. Many of you may be familiar with the discussion in step something or other of the in tradition. Oh, I wish I could remember it. Of the AA 12 and 12 about Rule 62. Do you know that story? It's a wonderful story where an AA group sets up rules for how it was going to conduct itself, and the rules keep adding up and adding up until they had 61 rules, and then the group just explodes. It just breaks up in anger, and the person who started this whole rule making sent out to everyone a folded piece of paper that said Rule 62. You open it up, it says, don't take yourself so damn seriously. And that's really what it should be. We should be joyous, happy, and free, as the Big Book says. That's the way we should be. And nothing should upset it. Nothing should upset our ability to handle life. I have many more things to say, but I always run out of time, but I feel much better. I got most of what I want to say. I'll just go through some of the questions. Can you apply the steps in all eating disorders, or do you sometimes have to look for a solution in the world of psychiatry? I have no position on outside issues. Some people, the Big Book talks about using medicine to help you, and certainly anyone who says you shouldn't go to a psychiatrist or you shouldn't take drugs is taking a position on outside issues. I'm not qualified to answer that. But it also says, gives an example of bulimia and anorexia, and I did want to talk a bit about that. I'm sure in this room, I heard in this room that there are people who have suffered from both bulimia and anorexia. I told you that Bill uses the word illness and not disease because he wanted to take it away from medicine. Here's an area where I wish medicine had not grouped together two very different kinds of people. The bulimic is no different from any other compulsive overeater, except he or she does a better job of hiding it. Really, when you think about it. They eat like pigs, I eat like pigs. The bulimic eats too much and then gets rid of it in some way. That's different from an anorexic who doesn't eat enough. And yet they're classified in somehow the same eating disorder because of psychiatric categorization. And that has meant that bulimics and anorexics somehow identify with each other because they go to the same eating disorder clinic. And the solution, I guess, is the same. You eat only so much and no more, and you don't purge. But within the anorexic community, if you will, to my understanding, there are at least two major differences. There are anorexics who have never, ever overeaten, who have never had anything, who have absolute body distortion images, who have control issues, but have never overeaten in their lives. And then there are the anorexics who have overeaten and have turned to anorexia as a solution to compulsive eating, to the overeating. And those, it seems to me, can identify with the stories of overeating that we mostly tell in the Overeaters Anonymous. And it might help them to understand that not all foods do it to them, that they have to figure out which foods have created their compulsive eating, and therefore not to be afraid of eating other foods that don't create it. It may be that our experience with the allergy of the body, as we talk about within this room anyway, might assist them. The bulimic, of course, needs no assistance. It's an eating behavior that they indulge in that they have to abstain from. The eating behaviors, whatever it is that they use to get rid of their extra calories. But they might also need psychiatric help, so I don't have a position on that. Do you think it is good, important to comment that another OAer's weight if they become too thin, and if so, how would you do it? I'd do a step 10 on that issue. I mean that. I mean, I say it glibly, but I really do mean it. I would. If I felt strongly about it, I would. Can you say something on the social side of being an OA, such as isolation, different people, etc.? Well, the promises are there. A community will grow, a fellowship will grow about you. You will make a host of friends. And as I was talking about with some people, I mean, we don't even know sometimes the last names of the people in OA. We don't know what they do. We don't know whether they're married, what relationships they have, what their sexual orientation is, what their jobs are. And yet we know them deeper than most people know other people. And it seems to me that's something. That's really a gift. I understood that we shouldn't sponsor people who are still into food. Would you sponsor an alcoholic who still drinks? Well, I will work with people until they figure out what mistakes they're making and don't make them again. Also, we should be absent to work the steps. I do believe that. Well, I don't believe that. I mean, that's been my experience. I mean, there are people who can do it the other way, I guess. I've never met them. But if there are people like that, God bless them. But the big book certainly stands for the proposition, takes for granted. You get sober, and then you work the steps. And I don't know how you can be honest with yourself in steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 if you're not honest about your food. But anyway, but the mental obsession with food won't be lifted until after step 9. The big question, how to get abstinent? The big book says we need to find a power greater than ourselves and find that power instead of working the steps. No, there's a difference. Getting abstinent doesn't mean recovery. There are people, and I've met many of them in OA, who are what's called, well, the equivalent of dry drunks, white-knuckle abstainers. There are people who have never taken the steps but use the power of the group to keep from eating or keep from drinking. They are abstinent, but that doesn't mean that they have recovered. Recovery is measured by the ability to be free of the mind, mental obsession that sends you back, by the freedom from the mental obsession that sends you back. And that's the measure of recovery. We get abstinent by hanging on with our knuckles, with our right knuckle, just hanging on. We do whatever we have to do to keep abstinent while we work the steps. So our minds are cleared, we're not drunks, and we're able to work the steps as clearly as possible. The steps give us recovery so that we no longer have to worry about being abstinent. We have the sanity to know we shouldn't eat it. What if the sponsee can't be abstinent? No, I've answered this. With the big book, does the concept of slipping and sliding exist? We hear often, I eat a vegetable in between the meal, but it's not compulsive. I eat more than I should, but it is okay. I don't eat sweets. How do I deal with it? My answer is, if your plan of eating is that you don't eat between meals, and you have eaten between meals without in any way making... I mean, I gave you an example when I ate between three meals a day when I was doing this strenuous bicycling, but I planned that. So I changed my plan of eating to adapt to my living situation. But if it's an unplanned and you've done it, you're no longer abstinent. Well, no big deal. I mean, if you, I don't know if you're familiar with the wonderful meditation book called As Bill Sees It, a publication of AA. It's a wonderful book which has a great index. It's like our For Today or our Voices of Recovery. If you look up slip in that or relapse, I can't remember. I think it's slip. You'll see Bill saying, you know what? Don't take this too seriously in the sense of figure out what you did wrong and don't do it again. You know, what does it matter that I've been 20 years absent and not 2 years absent? I suppose it does if I'm giving a workshop like this. I get greater authority if I've been 20 years absent. But if I slipped, I would feel awful if I did. But if I did, I'd own up to it. And I would say, I'm Laurie, I've been absent for 2 days or 3 days. I mean, I'm not going to spend my life regretting what I can't change. So... all I can say is that people who break their abstinence, break their abstinence. I answered that already. Have you ever fired a sponsee relapses? I did that. Oh, do I take them back? Like if they relapse, let's say they're on step 4 or step 5 or something and they relapse, I will work with them and I will say, what mistakes have you made? I told you about that already. And then they say, okay, why don't we, are you desperate? You understand step 1 and step 2? And they probably will say, I understand it better now than I understood it before. I understood how vulnerable I am to the mind, the mental obsession that sent me back. Say, let's do a step 3 prayer. Time to do another step 4, clearly. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Do I go on my knees each day to pray and thank God, as some AA says, step work says to do? No. Have I ever gone on my knees? Yes. Have you ever seen me go on my knees? No. Do the steps in different fellowships? Why? It's the same steps. Shouldn't they supposed to take any addiction away? Very interesting question. The man who helped me understand the steps and worked with me, the guy who had 15 years of sobriety in AA but had never been in OA, and I worked with him and we read the big book together, he was told by his sponsor, and Joe and Charlie say this too, focus on your primary addiction and the big book will solve all your problems. And he relapsed. He relapsed so badly that he died at the age of, 52, of multiple heart attacks. It was so pathetic to watch him. I kept trying to get him back. I can only say this, and I've had long discussions with a young friend of ours, actually a friend of my daughter's, but he's almost like a son to us because his mother's passed away, who has two addictions. And he didn't find in the two fellowships where he was much strength. He went to AA and said, I'll recover using AA. And what I said to him was this. Every fellowship, every 12-step fellowship has two major differences in the steps. One is the first step, what you're powerless over. And the other is to whom you carry the message. And how can you recover in one program without recovering in another, and carry the message to those in another program? If carrying the message is part of your recovery as an overeater, then shouldn't you be carrying the message to the compulsive eater who still suffers, and not just to the alcoholic who still suffers, or the drug addict who still suffers? My own experience, it's anecdotal, I don't know any statistics, is that the experience of every AA-er and any other member of a 12-step group who has been in OA is that working the steps in both is necessary. I have no answer. I can't say that that's absolutely true, but that's been my experience. It says, I'll go back to that. dealt with eating behaviors related situations. How do I deal with eating behaviors related situations like eating with relatives and big gatherings? These are trigger situations for me, or situations with meals that take hours or buffets. My answer is, my question would be, have you recovered or not? If you haven't recovered, I would say probably until you finish step 9, it might be good not to do that, or to bring your own food, or to have your cell phone handy and to phone someone the moment that you think you're about to eat something, to do whatever you need to do not to eat at those relatives' meals or at the buffets. If you've already worked step 9 and you have recovered and you're still afraid of them, do a step 10 on them and you'll know what to do. The Big Book actually, and I wanted to read this, has a wonderful passage on this issue. I'll start on page 100. Yeah, because I've dealt with all the questions. And I'm. Can I have 10 minutes? All I need is an extra. I just need 5 minutes, an extra 5 minutes. So 2:05. If you give me that, I'll finish the whole thing. Pardon me? Oh, it's working with others. It's page 100. It's the fourth last page. I've got it, actually. Page 112 of the Danish, paragraph 2. Assuming we're spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served, we must not have it in our homes, we must shun friends who drink, we must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes, we must not go into bars, we can't discuss food at meetings, our friends must hide their bottles if we go to their houses, we mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There's something the matter with his spiritual status. And they go on. In our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. We've tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. Our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking if we have a legitimate reason for being there. I love this. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, even plain, ordinary whoopee parties. And that would not mean anything to people whose language isn't English. As a matter of fact, it doesn't mean anything to people these days, because there are no such things as whoopee parties. But a whoopee party is just a place where you would, it's sort of like a Western whoopee, you know, where you drink and say, whoopee. Right now, the only whoopee around is what's called a whoopee cushion, which is a cushion that you sit on that creates the sound of fart or flatulence. But anyway, they say this: you will note we have made an important qualification. Therefore, ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good social, business, or personal reason for going to this place? Or am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere of such places? That has saved me on so many occasions. If I know why I'm there, and I have a purpose for being there, then my going there is much more protected than if I don't know why I'm going. If I'm going to a relative's place, oh God, I want to go there, there's going to be so-and-so, you know, Aunt so-and-so is going to be there, and they're going to pinch my cheek, and they're going to say you'd look so pretty if you weren't so fat, and all these things are going to happen. There's going to be all this food, and it's going to be, you know, so-and-so's cheesecake. If you go there, I mean, you know, you're sure to have problems. But if you say, why am I going there? Because I love my relatives, regardless of their, you know, their particular things that are annoying. And I want to show them love. And I want to show love to the people who've invited, the couple that's invited me. And I want to be there to show my love. Well, if you remember that that's your purpose, you have much less chance of giving in to temptation. It is really such a wonderful question to ask yourself. I really recommend it to you. We get our job description on page 102, which is page 113, paragraph 2 of the Danish version. Your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. Just a few other comments on groups. There's a description of groups in the Big Book which talks about them being full of laughter. Why laughter would we talk about such serious things? Because we've recovered and we have gratitude. We can talk happy about the sad things that have happened because we're no longer what we used to be. But I think that we have to consider how each group should be considering itself. How is it carrying the message to the person who still suffers? It may be a comfortable meeting for those who come to it, but is it a meeting at which those who still suffer understand, first of all, what the illness is and how and whether they seriously have our problem, so they know that they have our problem, and they know, therefore, that the only solution for them is probably a 12-step fellowship like ours. And if they don't have our problem, they shouldn't come, because this isn't a coffee klatch. It's not a place just to whine. It's a place to get recovery. And second of all, a group that emphasizes that recovery comes through the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous, because that's where recovery comes from. It doesn't come from anywhere else. At least that's our group conscience. I read it to you right at the beginning on the Friday evening. You know, the first policy motion ever passed says the 12 steps is what gives us our recovery. So there are many meetings around which are discussion meetings, which are lifeline meetings, which are tools of recovery meetings. And I'm not calling them down or saying that they're bad, but the question I have is, do they emphasize that regardless of what the topic is, the solution for compulsive eating is the 12 steps? Because if they don't, and the meeting that I ran, that I eventually closed, all it was a discussion meeting. Whoever was the leader that day would read a passage from OA or AA literature and talk about it. And it was really nice. And it was a small meeting, so we could talk on and on and on about what's going on in our lives and the difficulty things. And it was just a wonderful place to unload all the crap that we had in our lives. But it wasn't a meeting that talked about recovery. Well, none of us had recovered. And so it wasn't a meeting that challenged the people who came to it. There is a different way. You don't have to cry over the things that are happening. You can overcome them by using the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous. So I put that out for you. I just wanted, there's one other thing, and I've forgotten where it happens, where it is. It's about matching calamity with serenity. I just blanked. I know that page. I know the page. I know what side of the page it's on. To match calamity is horrible things happening with serenity. So we are able to match calamity with serenity. To match them. To be able, like a tennis match, to bring serenity to battle and to win over calamity. And I just want to tell a story because it's a very short story. I had a friend who had been in AA many, many years. I hadn't seen him for a while, but he used to be very wealthy. He had established a business, and he made a lot of money in that business. And then he lost it all because of a decision he had made. And he had no money left whatsoever. That's what I heard. I hadn't seen him for about a year. And I saw him on the street. I was happy to see him. How are you? You know, I knew that he was in bad financial state. I said, what are you doing now? He said, oh, I am now an orderly, a nurse's aide, I think that is what you might call it. I work at a hospital. And he said, I clean shit off men and give them dignity. I thought, there's a man who has matched calamity with serenity. He has found a purpose in his life. You know, he is doing something I would never want to do in my life, something I would find quite repulsive, but he's doing it and he knows why he's doing it. Not just to earn a job, but to help other people in a very humble, truly a humble way. I was overwhelmed by that. And I think that's another example of how we match calamity with serenity, how we can handle these things. Okay. I'll just go over the provocations to make sure I've covered them all. And then I will tell you a joke. And then I will finish by reading the big book. So, okay. I'm a recovered compulsive eater, not a recovering one. I think I've beaten that to death. Absence is not the most important thing in my life without exception. The consciousness of the presence of God is. I think I've shown that the reality is that once you recover, you are conscious of the presence of God, and that gives you your sanity, and your sanity makes your abstinence take it for granted. I don't eat butter because I don't want butter, because I'm sane, because I had a spiritual awakening, and I know that if I ate butter, it would be like poison to me. So I take my abstinence for granted as long as my spiritual condition is in good shape. Although a sponsor, if available, is very important for recovery, a sponsor is not necessary to recovery. I hope I've shown you that the instructions, although not always clear, are relatively simple, and you can do them. You can even do them on your own, but at least you could find another person who has the same desperation you have and do them together. And if you can't find a sponsor, you should also lower your expectations for a sponsor and not say, I need the perfect sponsor, because a sponsor is a person who simply guides you on your way. You do all the work, at least you should be. So I've done that. You can recover in weeks. I think I've shown how relatively quickly you can do that. If you can do step four in 2-3 weeks quite easily, and 5, 6, 7, and 8 are done the same day. So, you know, depending on how quickly you read and how hard you work, you can recover in weeks. The tools of recovery are not an essential part of the OA program. Only insofar as they relate to steps would they be essential, because it's the steps that are essential, not each tool. The tool is a way of helping to keep you abstinent while you're working the steps. And some of them work, and some of them, most of them don't work for me. Service sure didn't work for me. Telephone never worked for me. Abstinence worked for me, although I couldn't keep abstinent. Anonymity, I have no idea how that would keep me abstinent. Sponsorship. I wasn't able to sponsor. I was relapsing. But anyway, those are the tools. But whatever they are not the essence of the program. The essence of the program is the 12 steps. You don't take steps 1 and 2. I think I showed that. Steps 3, 6, 7, and 8 should not take a long time to get to. I think I showed that. You don't make amends to yourself. I discussed that. Now, you should not sponsor until after you've completed step 9. I use sponsor very, very carefully, and not probably in the way it's used in OA. There are many different kinds of sponsors in OA. There are step sponsors, there are food sponsors, there are 30-question sponsors, there are 70-question sponsors. And I don't want to misuse the word, and I think I should change the way I use it. The Big Book says in its last couple paragraphs, you cannot give away what you do not have. Clearly, if you have not recovered, you cannot give away your recovery. That doesn't mean you can't help someone else recover, just as the person who worked with me hadn't recovered and I hadn't recovered, and we helped each other recover. It doesn't mean you can't do service. It doesn't mean you can't ask people questions. It doesn't mean you can't, what other people would say, is sponsor to the best of your ability. But you can't give away what you don't have. And I just want to make that distinction. Service is not slimming. All through this program, all through the hundreds and maybe thousands of people I've met and all the Big Book studies I've done, and before that and all the work I've done at Region and World Service, I have met service junkies. Junkies are drug addicts. They're service addicts. And invariably, like me, who was a service junkie, they can be as fat as ever. And it's not slimming. It used to be the slogan in a way that service is slimming. It's not slimming. The reason for service is twofold. One kind of service is to carry the message of recovery to those who still suffer. The other is to keep Overeaters Anonymous alive. And that kind of service can be done by anyone, regardless of where they are in the steps. You know, make the coffee, clean up, help with the newsletter and all that. But that doesn't necessarily keep you slim, and it doesn't necessarily help you work the steps. You have to work the steps. It might keep you busy, and if it keeps you busy, you might not eat. That's a good thing. You know, it might keep you absent and help keep you absent while you're working the steps, but that's all. 11, food can be discussed at meetings. That doesn't seem to be a problem mostly here, but it is absurd to think of not being able to tell your individual stories of eating. How can I tell my goose story or my story of eating at the restaurant or my stories of the food or the ice cream, eating all the ice cream, if I can't mention those foods? There's a wonderful speaker from Toronto who I'm going over my 5 minutes. Can I have a bit more time? Thanks. I'll be very short. Very short, I promise. Very, very short. Anyway, he talked about a meeting which you couldn't discuss food, and the person said, I ate little white balls of creamy stuff. And three people met afterwards and said, we couldn't listen to the rest of her speak because we kept trying to figure out what was it that she ate. And they each had three different things that they were thinking of. Each had different ones, and then they asked her and she had the fourth, you know. It's ridiculous not to be able to discuss food. That's our story. We're telling our stories. And 12, some people who come to OA should really understand, anyone who comes to OA should understand what it means to have a desire to stop eating compulsively. And we owe a duty in our meetings to explain the problem and the solution so people can self-identify and know that they do deserve to be here. They should not be abusing our trust and our confidence by using us as confidants, as shoulders to cry on, as whiners. Either they're here to work the steps or they're not. If they can't work the steps now but they are desperate, they can stay, and we should. And I would never kick anyone out, of course. But it's their responsibility to figure that out. Okay. Those are the 12 provocations. I want to thank you so much for inviting me. I can't tell you how wonderful an experience it has been, and how wonderful it's been to be able to communicate with people here, and how exciting it is to have people from all over Europe. I can't tell you how much of a privilege it has been. You may be helping me much more than I may be helping you. I've done workshops. I've come back 5 years later, and people have said, "Oh, you were so great 5 years ago. I had to come now." I said, "How are you doing?" "Oh, I had relapses. I'm just absent now after two months." And I think to myself, "Boy, I really had an impact." You know, so I'm not fooling myself. You know, I can be inspirational. I can talk all well. But it's all on you and your responsibility as to whether you recover or not. But you've helped me recover, so I thank you. Here's a story. It's an AA story, very brief. A man gives a speech, an AA member, long-timer, gives a speech at an AA meeting, and he gets a standing ovation. And people are cheering, and they come up to him afterwards. "Thank you so much. That was the most inspiring thing." "Don't thank me, thank God." "Oh, your interpretation of step 6 was brilliant. It changed my whole interpretation of the program." "Don't thank me, thank God." And a long-timer comes up and says, "Boy, that was a good speech." "Don't thank me, thank God." The long-timer looks at him and says, "It wasn't that good." I never, ever want to be a star. In my first year in this program, years and years ago, I was a star because I have the gift of gab. I know I do. You know, my last name is Cherniak. My teacher in grade 8 said my name was Cherniak-yak-yak. So I've talked all my life. I don't ever want to be a star. And I know I'm not a star. I'm telling you what I've been taught. And I just want to thank you so much. So I just want to finish up by reading page 164 of the big book, which is the ending. It's page 166 of the Danish edition, paragraph 1. "Still, you may say, but I will not have the benefit..." Oh, and I'm asked to tell you to stay seated after I finish, because there's something they want to talk about. "Still, you may say, but I will not have the benefit of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that, so you must remember your real reliance is always upon Him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past." But you'll notice that's steps 4, 5, and 9, right? "Give freely of what you find and join us." Well, that's step 11, step 4, step 5, step 9. "We shall be," and step 12, "we shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny." May God keep you, bless you, and keep you until then. Thank you.